Welcome to Empower to Grow, the podcast. I am your host, Hanan Ulbasha.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to a new episode of Empower to Grow in Business podcast. Actually, this is episode 199. So I'm super excited. This is also a milestone, and I've had amazing conversations to date. And today, I promise you, I have another very empowering, very exciting conversation with my guest, Henry Dufault, one of my favorite people over the past year, him and his beautiful wife, Dr. Allison Stone, who unfortunately is not going to be joining us today, but I do promise you I will bring her on the podcast soon, because they are people who, first of all, there was alignment from the first moment we met in Web Summit 2024. But more importantly, they have a lot of values and vision, and they work very hard to bring it to life. So please help me in welcoming Henry. Hi, Henry.
Hey, Dr. Anand. How are you?
Thank you so much. Thank you for being here. I know I've been harassing you and Allison for forever to get on the podcast, and you guys are very busy and traveling
all around. We made it. I was trying to get to 200, episode 200. So that's why I was kind of like playing hard to get.
Yeah, I know. You wanted the milestones, right?
Yeah. That's why.
187 is not good enough. It's 199 that we have to get to. Henry, you are a co-founder and CEO of the Geftas Institute, and I love what you guys are doing, but tell our audience a bit more about you and what you're doing at the Geftas, please.
Quickly. The Gefta Institute, it's a research institute or research enterprise on prosperity. So basically what we focus on, and it's really the culmination of what we've been doing the last 20 years, right? A lot of work in terms of startups, in terms of innovation, in terms of supporting mission-driven founders and so forth, working with universities and so forth. And what we do with the Gefta Institute is there are three segments. The first one is a lot of research, really on human potential, but also the implication on human potential on anything from AI to urban theory, communication theory, different aspects as well too. So we have six research faculties doing a lot of core research. We also partner with a lot of universities and organizations like Fulbright towards scholarships in what we call prosperity intelligence. So that's the first segment. The second segment of what we do with Gefta is a lot of community building. So we partner with local stakeholders and community sort of operators that want to launch projects, whether it's in education, health and wellness, entrepreneurship. They want to launch incubators, for example, economic development initiatives, skill building, and so forth. And the third segment is where we work with founders, right? We support what we qualify as prosperity ventures, founders that have absolutely unreasonable ambitions about what they want to create, right? Not just in terms of the financial aspiration, but also in terms of the type of impact they want to cultivate in society. So with those founders, we support them, provide them a lot of guidance in terms of how to structure and how to scale their operations. So that's kind of like what we do with the Geftas Institute. And just what preceded that, because we launched it in January, it's 20 years of working with startups, right? So that's how kind of like we got started on that trajectory, working and scaling tech startups, still, again, startup that had social dimensions, right? That basically it wasn't just about the financial pursuit, but also those extra financial consideration, working in Canada originally, then the US, then Europe, and then the Middle East now, working with these mission-driven founders. But in addition to working with these founders, do a lot of work with investors, family offices that are looking into early stage investment as part of their portfolio, as part of their investment thesis. In addition to that, a lot of work with government offices, economic development offices that are looking to leverage entrepreneurship as a means for economic growth. And finally, with a lot of universities, a lot of academic institutions that need help in terms of commercializing a lot of the IP that they've been able to sort of create. So that's kind of like what we've done. And the work we're doing with Geftas actually follows on a lot of what we've done with the refinery for the last 20 years.
It's a pinnacle of bringing it all together under one umbrella and kind of having it clearly driven.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's been an interesting journey because, I trace back when the first documents on Geftas were actually formulated in the team, it's like 2007,
Wow. Okay.
It's been very intentional in terms of that trajectory. And it's always funny because for people that we've worked in the past, sometimes it was very hard for them to piece together all the stuff that we've done, because we've done, you know, we've had construction projects, we've done, you know, stuff in entertainment, we had telecom companies and so forth that, you know, we've operated, some we've sold and so forth, but it was always intentional. It was always leading up to the work that we're doing now with Geftas, you know, thankfully.
And what I love about it is that it is in total alignment with who you are as as both as individuals and as professionals and in your value system. Yeah. And that brings me to my question to you. Alignment, the importance of alignment between founder and investor. And I know we've had this conversation multiple times. Not a lot of people, first of all, focus on alignment. I know, like, you know, for founders, as a tech founder myself, you know, we need funds, you know, fundraising. Anyone who's going to write us a check is good enough. But I know for me personally, but maybe this is something we want to talk about, picking the right investor is also important. So tell us a bit more about that and your experiences in kind of helping that alignment.
Yeah, it's key, right? And there's a divide often between founders and investors, right? Because if you synthesize what founders are focused on, a lot of it, even the language they use, it's very mission-centric, right? Yeah. It's about what compelled them to action, right? It's really, you know, it almost has that very romantic feel. And when you talk to investors and when you talk about their point of departure, it's very, and obviously if you remove if you remove all the virtue signaling about, we want to invest for the future generation and so forth and so forth, all that stuff as well too.
We'll put that on the side.
So basically a lot of, if you really synthesize that from the investor's perspective, it's very return centric, right? So it's not about the mission. It's not about the romantic sort of side of it. It's really return centric. So the challenge for founders is to be able to translate their vision into the corresponding economic model, right? And that's not an exercise that a lot of founders like. You know, it's kind of like try to talk to someone who's met their soulmate about quantifying, you know, that fit, right? That synergies. Try to figure out the computation that went into sort of brokering that union. So a lot of people are like, well, you know, you're robbing me of the romance of that stuff. But it's imperative, because your job as a founder, right, is to maximize optionality for your project, right? Basically, so every decision you take along the way, from who you partner with, you know, the source of capital as well too, and even they have an impact on your ability to deliver on your journey, right? So it's really about mobilizing the right, whether it's investors and so forth. So you need to be able to extract yourself from that almost mission-centric standpoint and allow other people to be able to appreciate your ventures from their perspective. And from an investment perspective, it's from the return profile of the company, right? They have to understand the economic engine that you have built, right? And then allow them to connect the dot to see what's the measure of opportunity that you're presenting as an investor, you know, based on my investment thesis, based on my imperative as well to be able to make money from my investors, right? To be able to keep growing and raising subsequent funds and so forth. So it's really that reconciling that really sort of mission-centric perspective with one that is more econometric centric, right? Well, really translating that and allowing you really your economic vehicle and how you create value to shine.
Would you say that is applicable both at, like, at every stage? We have the pre-seed, the seed, you know, series A, B, C, and we have different type of investors at each stage. We have the angels, possibly family offices. Then we look at the VCs and, you know, there are CVCs, the corporate venture capitals and stuff. Do you think that is applicable at every stage, or the kind of romanticizing still exists with angel investors?
It can, and you'll never lose that side, right? And you'll know in which rooms where this is an asset, right, where you can leverage this. But it's imperative to be able to do that, because there's a cost to every dollar you raise, right? There's a cost. And your ability to understand your business from the economic standpoint shows your ability to appreciate the cost of actually seeding equity for dollars. Right.
Okay.
So most founders, you know, if you look, and that's an exercise we always ask for our founders, is figure out the entire spectrum of capital requirement you'll need to do along the journey. Right. Not just, you know, this round, but even try to play it down in a fully actualized version of the project. Right. Try to figure out how much you'll, and you'll realize your initial raises are the most expensive of that journey.
Yes.
And what happens to, you know, your project and your ability to lead your project in 5 years, four, they're actually sort of a function of how much equity you've actually sold, right? And a lot of people, when you look back, a lot of founders, they're like, wow, it was easy money. And that's, you know, it requires a lot of discipline as well. So it's like, yeah, I got my friends or so forth and so forth. But when you actually factor in the equity you had to give out, right, and the opportunity cost of that as well too, then you start realizing, like, you know, going back, maybe I would have structured those rounds differently. Maybe I would price them differently as well too. So mm-hmm. it's really important to be able to get into that mode, because you're the custodian of that vision, that mission. And it's imperative mm-hmm. that you put the project in the best position where it can continue to have access to capital, right? And that's really important as well too, because there's such thing as well too of having too an easy time raising capital. And then you're forced now to revisit your valuation, you know, you have a down round and so forth, and that could be catastrophic as well too. So it's having that discipline from the get-go.
But for, you know, Henry, you've worked with all the way from the university students who are aspiring entrepreneurs to seasoned entrepreneurs. How difficult is it for those that are first timers or even repeat, but they haven't had, you know, success fundraising before or have very small rounds, as you said, like the first round with the friends and family was more than enough to get the business up and going. How can someone acquire this skill? Because you're asking for a lot of reflection, introspection, and also projection into the future. How can someone acquire this skill if they don't have someone like an investor having their back in their corner to educate them about these things?
It's the way we started, right? So when we started, it was all about profiling the people we were talking to, right? The audience, right? That's imperative as well, too, in terms of having that discipline. It's not about just going after investors and so forth, but going through the exercise of profiling them, try to get a good understanding of their perspective, their investment thesis, mm-hmm. and even try to predict what will happen of the meetings, right? In terms of questions that they're going to have. So it's all experiments, right? You're basically practicing, right? But it's mm-hmm. important to be able to have that as much context as possible leading to that process. So the first thing is really that profiling, right? Mm-hmm. Getting a good understanding of who you're talking to, because again, it's a process where 90% of the money is the wrong money anyways for you and your project, right? That's number one.
Sure.
The second thing as well, too, that's very important about being able to profile those investors, and that's probably the most important, is to be able to contextualize the feedback you're getting from those investors, right?
Okay.
You're going to have people meeting 100 investors, and they pivot 100 times because of the feedback they're getting left and right, right? So without being able to understanding the messenger, then even that exercise could be very disruptive. I'll give you an example, right? I'm not going to name any names because I'm not trying to make
anybody... No names.
So when we got started, we had a project, really interesting project, and in kind of it was a marketplace as well too. We pitched it to a couple of U.S. investors after a lot of work, and our choice investor decided to back us on that. And coming back mm-hmm. to Montreal, one of our advisors was super interested. He's like, "Wow, great momentum. Let me connect you with another potential investor." So that investor operated a marketing company, and he had written a book. And part of that process profiling, we decided to read the book. And it wasn't the most enlightening book. It wasn't, you know, it lacked a lot of substance. So as we're reading it, we're doing this favor to this advisor, but we don't see a fit with that investor. So anyways, we take the meeting, we pitch the meeting, and he's basically raining our parade. He's like, "You can't do this. It's not possible. It will never work," and so forth. And I'm, you know, again, I'm laughing a little bit listening to that. And at the end, I told him, like, "Actually, by the way, I just got back from New Mexico, and that investor has backed us." And his response was like, "Well, I'm not an expert." That's basically, so after 30 mm-hmm. minutes of complaining and criticizing the model and so forth, then he basically blurted out, like, "Well, I'm not an expert," right?
Wow.
But if I hadn't been able to profile him, right, and contextualize the feedback, I would have taken that on.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And part of the process for a lot of founders, you know, you get beat up, right? It's exhaustive to have to pitch to 100 and so forth. So that's also part of the information. It's really important to go through and that process, having armed with that information. So you're able to, yes, fit alignment, be able to do that, but also contextualize all the information that you're being bombarded with as well, too. So the first thing is really know your audience, profile them, and adjust accordingly.
That's I love that you've mentioned that, because that also supports you in getting in showcasing your conviction of the idea, but also being open to understanding when and how and where to pivot depending on feedback.
Absolutely.
Because when that is not solid, then as you said, every feedback you get kind of pivots you or makes you lose faith in what you're building.
Absolutely. And the thing is that you need that energy as a founder, right? That convictions to be able to mobilize people. So if you basically, because you're improperly matched with investors and you go through that process and so forth, and, you know, you see founders after 2-3 months, they're, you know, borderline depressing, you know, on depression. Yeah. But the thing is that had they been able to structure and you know, orchestrate that sequence of introduction and you know, ranking those leads and so forth, it would have been a much more informative process, right?
Yeah.
Where you're able to sort of take in and even enjoy it, right? You know, sometimes you take meetings with people you don't necessarily think there's affinity, and you know, it's very relaxed. Yeah. And some things, it could be practice, it could be, you know, really answering questions that come from a completely different perspective because you see how foreign the concept might be to those investors. It could even be in terms of introduction to other people and so forth, but then you see it more as a practice, right? So that's something that's very important.
Is it very difficult to draw boundaries with your investors? Because I know that some investors are kind of, especially, again, we're talking about the early stages with the angel investors and stuff, they kind of breathe down your neck and want to support you, quote unquote, by kind of, you have to see this and you have to read that and you have to change this and stuff. And there are others that are completely chill, but they kind of hammer you with this kind of intimidation of what are you up to and are you doing the right thing and stuff. Is there a healthy boundary you need to establish with your investor?
So obviously it's matchmaking, right? Most investors are the wrong investors for your project, right? That's the reality. Mm-hmm. And it's important in that profiling to also have an understanding of, beyond capital, what are all the other contributions that these investors are able to make, right? So it's kind of like you're allowing some people to talk about the business because you've seen that as far as the IP that they bring to the table, there's relevance, right? It makes sense to talk to them about them. Others investors who do not have that kind of assets to bring to the table, you're not meant to discuss. You know, let's say, oh, well, I'm thinking about, you know, reorienting the business strategy and so forth. If that's not part of their profile card, then, you know, you're not meant to have those conversations. And investors, they kind of see how you respond to that information. And that's an indicator of what kind of behavior they're allowed to have as well. Right.
Okay.
If they see, it's kind of like, you know, we operate amongst all the business that we've done, we operate a movie company as well, too. And I remember speaking to a director. And he says, every question you're being tested on, right? So it doesn't matter if it's a lining person and so forth. And if you don't know the answer, don't answer, because your entire production will aptly unravel, right? And it's the same thing with investors. If they ask you questions and you're not sure and so forth, best to retract yourself from that conversation. I'll think about it. But if they see doubt, then they're, you know, that's going to have an amplifying effect, right? So there's clear boundaries based on their profile and based on the impact, really. But again, if it's an investor that does have context, that does have that background, then you could talk. Just if they've done a lot of work in terms of marketing and, you know, scaling and rolling out companies, then you get to talk to them about user acquisition, right? And you get, you know, just to be able to pull from that. But it's very, very important to have those boundaries. It's your show.
Well, speaking of kind of looking at things from a different perspective, you have a completely different perspective when it comes to social impact and economic impact and looking at it from a business perspective and creating ventures and funds to be able to support that. And this is kind of the topic where I wanted to delve into with you today. Tell us a bit more about that. Like, what are you seeing that could be done differently to not just change the status quo, but more importantly, create more economic and social impact that is not being done right now?
Well, it's very interesting, right? Because basically what we tell people is we don't go into talk to founders and say, oh, you need to embed some social consideration, right?
Yeah.
We tell people just be honest about who they are and what they're pursuing. because a lot of people, a lot of companies will say, oh, well, you know, we care about society and so forth. And they'll try to do something that basically will never take roots, really. And the truth of the matter is every organization, every company is just an organic extension of the founders, right? So if the founder doesn't care about certain things, it's not going to work, right? There's nothing that happens by accident. You can't dissociate the creator and the creation. So whether it's you hear about companies that have toxic cultures, you know, the companies that, you know, there are certain practices that it's basically it's an extension of the founders. These do not happen by accident, right? So if you think that we can just go to in companies and try to impose certain values and principles and you know, again, those extra financial pursuit, it's not going to happen, right? It's about supporting those founders that naturally the way they're thinking is, and most people, right? Most people are very, they're very decent, they're principled, they're ethical as well too. They always factor in those considerations to the type of business they want to create, right? They make those calculations as far as what is the second or third order consequences of what I'm trying to build, right? Yeah. How does the world, you know, is the world better because of what I'm bringing to the table? And what you end up learning is that for 90% of the people, you don't have to talk to them about impact. They already have those, it's embedded in how they think, how they see the world, because they know they will have to live with whatever world they create, right? And they understand that, you know, life is, it's a cooperative game, right? It doesn't matter if you breed in China, you breed this air in Qatar, right? It's kind of like that. So, but what we do tell founders is to be almost unapologetically committed to their values, right? If this is what you want to build, you know, it's meant to serve you as well, right? It's meant to serve you as well. So if you do care about specific causes, specific stakeholders, don't hide them, right? If this is the type of culture you want to build, build it, right? Be authentic with those. And when you give them the freedom and really the encouragement to really make this a very personal journey, then you find out that those layers are already integrated into that, right? So that's the one thing as well, too, because we see a lot, and it's even on the investment side, you see a lot of impact funds. And you look at the thesis makes absolutely no sense. Right. And if you look at, and it's revealed when you look at the
checklist, they're going through the checklist. Okay, this seems like a good gap to fill, but sorry, on conviction again.
Absolutely. And the truth of the matter is, even if you look at a lot of the metrics on impact and so forth, a lot of it comes from sin stock. It's basically metrics that allow you to qualify funds or investments that could turn out to lawsuits later on, right? It's basically to be able to diagnose. That's all it is. It's not necessarily it's not really about looking at the prosperity sort of measure of a project. It's basically if there's anything as far as the configuration of a business, you know, those externalities like, you know, labor practices and so forth that could be problematic, then that will get flagged by the impact metrics, right? But as far as, you know, again, that disconnect is the same in terms of investors. And when you look at the thesis of a lot of investors and funds, and then you basically see how that translates into the portfolio and the choices they've made in investment, they're like, well, there's definitely a disconnect here, right? So what we always advise people, we're not there to convert anybody, is just be very honest, be very, very authentic and genuine about what are your pursuit, right? So that's kind of like what's really important. And once you allow people to have that, you know, give themselves almost the right to sort of really internalize and really personalize their journey, then you see really beautiful projects.
The problem is that, you know, from the work I've done and I've seen is that I've witnessed there's always a resistance when you bring up social impact or social entrepreneurship, because there's this resistance always. And we've seen it kind of on the investment side, on the advisory side, on people backing it up. It's like, you know, measuring it is difficult. And I've had a conversation all about social impact and entrepreneurship with Luisa Baltazar, amazing lady. She's doing a lot of work, Portuguese, by the way. I have to hook you guys up. But it's always, there isn't a lot of money in it, and it's always difficult to measure.
Yeah.
And I see those founders working towards social, or who are social impact driven, are finding it difficult, as you said, to convey their authenticity in a way, back to the beginning of the conversation, that is about, you know, the metrics that need to be heard.
100%. And, you know, a lot of the space in terms of social investment, social impact investment gets a bad name, rightfully so, right?
Yeah.
When you look at, again, if people do a little bit of research in terms of the genesis of a lot of those metrics and so forth, they're not applicable to most projects. They're not as well too. And funds that commit, you know, almost, an orthodox matter to impact metrics, they don't perform well. That's the truth of the matter is as well too. But the challenge for a lot of these mission founders, if you desire to launch a project, okay, we always say this to founders, right? If you believe your project is definitely going to move the needle in terms of cultivating positive change in society, it's delivering in terms of the value creation mechanism, things that are extremely transformative for your stakeholders, you have a moral obligation to make it as big as possible. Okay. So it's not where you're like, well, because I have those social consideration, I'm compromising on returns, on growth, yep, on economic activities. No. You absolutely, it's imperative that you figure out a way to translate that, really that passion, that force, that lucidity into a high performing, economically efficient engine, right? So then it's not so much about, well, we need to use metric, and there's different ways as well too. There's a lot, you know, things like dynamic materiality as well too, that allows to identify which metrics are relevant to your projects, right? Even if you want to do something more impact. But the truth of the matter is that if it is something that needs to be shared and that needs to be cultivated and needs to be sort of actualized as well too, then, you know, it's, you need to figure out the economic architecture, right? How to make it the economic. And then the conversation is kind of like, second, right? You build something that is economically viable, right? It's profit. The valuation creation mechanism works, and in addition, it is regenerative because it does good, right? Because factor in all the impacts it cultivates for all the stakeholders. If you do a proper, very comprehensive audit, it is a good project. It democratizes access to things that are important, and so forth and so forth. So that's kind of like what we always try to hammer down to a lot of these mission-driven founders, like, yeah, good job. You've received that mission. But now the challenge is figuring out the economic architecture and, you know, of the project. And that's often the more boring work, the less inspiring work for a lot of these founders.
Yeah, that's true. Because a lot of, again, and I'm not generalizing, but a lot of the mission-driven initiatives are very specific to segments that a lot of investors cannot see the scalability of, and that's where you start getting stuck.
Exactly. And it wouldn't be a problem if you didn't need to have access to outside capital. If you had all the money in the world, you build the way you want, right? You build the restaurant the way, you know, and it's open an hour and a year. It doesn't matter.
Exactly.
But the reality is that you need to procure capital from people that are not converted to that idea, right? So you need to be able to mobilize. And that's the challenge, right? That's your mission. That's part of the mission as well, too. How to be able to mobilize these people that have completely different imperatives, right? Again, we're talking about investors. It's if they do not generate revenues and returns, they're closing down, right? So it's being able to get all the stakeholders. It's kind of like, and again, that's an exercise with all the founders, like, look at all the capital requirements, but all the assets requirements for your project over, let's say, the next 10 years and so forth. This gives you an idea of who you will need to mobilize in order to be able to materialize that vision. And there's a variety of backgrounds, different perspective, and your idea will need to make sense to all these different perspectives. So you need to extract yourself from, you know, your own sort of perspective, and to be able to sort of engage with those where they can sort of translate what you're trying to convey.
You've worked across multiple ecosystems, which entail multiple legislative and kind of infrastructures as well. Do you believe that is it about just the policies and the legislations that would be able to support more social impact, or it doesn't matter where you are in the world, you can still create that? As you said, it's about the economics or the metrics and that kind of infrastructure.
Yeah, well, it depends who you task with building the economic framework, right? The business framework, right? It's one thing if because again, we did a lot of work with economic development offices, and there's different techniques, right? Some technique is to just try to copy what's done in Silicon Valley, right?
Yeah.
Which actually doesn't even work in Silicon Valley. So that's a secret. in terms of return efficiency. So some will be, let's just try to copy and play and pray that one big company emerge from that, right? So focus all our energies, but then you're basically subject to whatever that company is going to become, right? In terms of priorities, in terms of values, and so forth. Other models are, let's try to import, let's say an Amazon, right? And say, this is how we want to jumpstart our economic model. So we will basically cater to Amazon, right? The entire ecosystem. And then again, that makes you sort of subject to whatever preferences Amazon has as well too. If you try to basically democratize access to entrepreneurship and you want to really support the emergence of a variety of entrepreneurs and founders, what's going to happen is, especially because it's homegrown, you're going to find out that those considerations are already baked in terms of social consideration, because it's not necessarily calibrated by foreign elements that don't have to live in the place and so forth. And truth of the matter is, those big companies are already planning to leave your ecosystem as soon as a more desperate ecosystem is going to offer them a better package deal as well too. But if you, the goal is to build robust ecosystem and really provide resources to people that are really attached and they will remain attached to your ecosystem, then you don't even have to have a conversation about, yeah, we should be very mindful of the type of impact we're creating, the type of products as well too, that we're creating as well too. So it's really about the strategy that employed in jumpstarting a lot of that, you know, knowledge-based economies, right? So it's so if you're smart and if you want to do it local with local ingredient and something that is compatible, just like in Qatar, you know, the 2030 plan, or in Saudi, if it is anchored into the specificities of Qatar and Saudi, then you have a higher probability that it will be very, very compatible with the values that have done so well for the community for so long. And then you find out that the inspiration, and that's something that's very interesting as well too. When we started working internationally, we worked everywhere, you know, a lot of different places. And one of the things that was very great observation is that even the differences of cities, whether it's Montreal and New York, you saw expression of those differences in the founders and the ideas that they had, right? So, you know, if you're in Montreal, more creative quality of life and so forth, you might have different types of ideas and so forth, but it's important to be able to create that very, very healthy environment. And again, just like we're talking about founders being authentic, is those communities being authentic about what defines them, what makes them special, right? What makes you, and be very, very, very disciplined and only allow for the emergence of, and even the introduction of stakeholders that are compatible with that. Right.
Yeah. I'm thinking of, you know, so I, as you know, I've studied international business and more important kind of internationalization for sustainable growth. And I know sustainable growth is kind of the essence of what you talk about in part of your work. Localization is very, very important for the success in other markets. What you are saying now is kind of the essence of it. It's not just about the localization of the ideas, but also in kind of the success parameters and metrics from around the world to be able to create something that works for you.
Absolutely.
Let's talk a little more about that, but also tying it in with sustainable growth. Because I know that, you know, building a business is great. We can, I'm on business number 9, but I know that, you know, businesses, you can start a business every day, but being able to sustain the growth of a business is a completely different ballgame.
Absolutely.
What are your views on that? Looking forward, how do you create a venture forward that is focused on impact and sustainable growth?
But again, you know, again, with that local dimension, right? Understanding, you know, talent is everywhere. There are 8 billion geniuses on the planet. That's a fact, right? And every community has to start with that mindset that as an ecosystem, we're rich. Right. We have human capital. It's about how we harness that human capital. Right. Again, that's kind of like sort of the mindset that's it's necessary to be able to say our starting point is we have people. Let's have them mine that wealth. Right. Let's get them sort of extract the full value there. And so and again, if you built with those consideration, every founder that emerged from that has those sustainability goals. This is their home. Right. This is where they've been able to benefit from in terms of how they were shaped by the environment, the ecosystem, and so forth. They have a love relationship with the ecosystem, right? So
that's why they want to benefit their own economy.
That's exactly it. And, you know, you hear stories of people, you know, again, not going to name any names, but, you know, some big silicon, you know, we were in New Zealand last year, spent a couple of months there. And you hear stories of a lot of Silicon Valley guys that came in and completely disrupted. They were incompatible with the fabric there. And people were really sort of disillusioned as far as the impact they could have as well, too. Because, again, these were foreign elements that didn't necessarily adhere to, let's say, the social contract locally in terms of consideration, how they interacted and so forth and so forth. So that backfired a little bit for people there. But it's important if you're able to promote that kind of like local genius, local resource, local assets, that human capital as well too, what you find out is that 90% of founders, again, it's baked in. The social sustainability consideration, it's baked in, right? They're not, they're thinking in a way that's very, very different than people that are so removed from the consequences that for them, you know, it couldn't matter as well too. And that's also what's exciting about a lot of places like in Qatar and in the region as well too, that are transitioning to that knowledge-based economy. Yeah. There's some ways to do it properly where even in 100 years, the essence of Qatar will remain, still be able to have thriving founders and people that were, let's say, Qatar compatible. That will be able to embrace the values, the constitution, really, in terms of, you know, the makeup of Qatar. Yeah. If you're able to do that, then again, and like I said, you know, sustainability gets a bad name because business. You know, you look at business in society, but it's not so much business that's inherently devoid of these type of sustainability considerations. It's the people that right now are champions of industries that do not really care about that, right? And if you profile them, you'll understand why. But again, the goal is to be able to democratize access, who gets to build to entrepreneurship. And ideally, the closer proximity they have to the ecosystem, the better they'll be able to impact, not just from a money standpoint, but again, those extra financial considerations.
And this is really important because, as you said, I've seen amazing and I've read about amazing impactful in every way, economically, social, environmentally, concepts coming out of Africa that might not necessarily be scalable all around the world. It could be just Africa-centric because it is resolving some problems that are just in Africa or in countries similar. And they have the essence of it is creativity, but also applicability to their ecosystem.
It's interesting because, you know, we do a lot of work in emerging, you know, ecosystem as well, too. And what you do realize is that a variation of that idea is scalable, right? Is scalable because the reality, it doesn't matter if, you know, there's greater proximity between the reality of someone in Accra in Ghana to someone in India or someone in, you know, in Mexico. Than there is from someone in Silicon Valley who's, again, it's just the way it is, right? It's basically there's, you know, the starting point dictates, you know, your end point as well too, between that person and someone in Venezuela. So in terms of just the potential of the idea to be exported, to become, you know, the engine of an incredibly valuable business, yes, there is definitely that potential in a lot of those areas, right? There's a lot of similarities in terms of, and you know, the problems that are solved are problems that plague, let's say, 90% of society as well too. So there's that economic potential there as well too. But again, it just requires a little bit of support to be able to allow those founders to be able to share their ideas and to obviously formulate the version of that as well too. And it's coming, right? A lot of those places, and you know, if we're looking at, we're tracking the best sites of innovation. If we try to project over the next 30 years, it will come from places that people are not necessarily associating with innovation right now. And some of the best place for the best ideas, you know, even in terms of just economic value, will come from these places, 100% of the, you know. 100%.
That's true. I agree. So Henry, we've covered kind of the founder perspective on finding and in kind of documenting aligned investors. Yeah. We've spoken about kind of, you know, the impact and everything, and that was more about the businesses and the impact that's supposed to be created. Let's kind of wrap it up talking about the investor. As an investor from that perspective, the investor mindset.
Yeah.
How is it that you would approach, or how is it that you do approach those that you are interested in investing? You know, like kind of turning the table around.
Yeah.
But also I want to address what is happening. Like the headlines are nonstop every day that it's all about all the turmoil that is happening, all the, whether it's tariffs or, you know, political unrest or economic difficulties. How can an investor kind of also be focused and centered at a time that is so, it's not like, okay, I'm just going to hang on, no investments for the next 2 years, because that's also not possible. And we've also have a burst, as you were talking earlier, you know, we've got the technology, we've got AI, we've got all of this happening.
So yeah.
Talk to us from an investor perspective now.
Yeah. So, you know, turbulence breeds opportunity, right? So as an investor, you always know turbulence breeds opportunity. There's a lot, and obviously it helps when you have a global perspective, right? A global perspective. But that's what's really exciting about a lot of these changes as well, too, where now countries are looking to say, well, you know, we cannot rely on, you know, the old paradigms. And even, you know, I'm Canadian, same thing in Canada. Now Canada has to redefine its economic framework, and it's long overdue. It's long overdue, right? An opportunity. Some people say, oh, you know what, you know, at the end of the day, this is an opportunity to be able to harness, you know, whatever Canadian potential. I don't spend that much time there, but, you know, it's an opportunity. How do you redefine yourself? How do you translate that adversity into actually gains, right? And upside. So it's going to be a tremendous, you know, a lot of people are waking, and obviously we spend a lot of time in the US as well too. And it's been, you know, for, you know, 20 years, you know, very, there's been, not to say in terms of complacency, but right now there's energy in the United States in terms of, you know, we need
drive.
To take part.
Yeah.
And that's positive, right? So in terms of if we're just looking at one country, yeah, then it, you know, it could be harder to get excited and so forth. But when you look at what's happening everywhere around the world, where people now are being emboldened, it could be just because now they have to have more self-agency or self-reliance and so forth. And they're looking as like, look, we have people too as well too. We have ideas. Let's start building these things. I don't think there's ever been. And another thing that's interesting as well too is that historically the U.S. have always had a very decisive advantage in terms of innovation, just because of the sheer volume of projects being created there. Yeah. And what that does in terms of seeing all these projects taking shape, and not just a successful one, right? We call them venture experiments. They're experiments. Every project is an experiment.
That's
and
true.
Being able to see the failures and so forth, by seeing the sheer volume of investment, you go from being very risk averse to, you know, and very sort of, you know, downside protection minded to wanting to now start identifying those patterns, right? Those patterns in the predictive success. So you get that confidence now to be able to get into VC and investing in something. Your reading of the situation. And now what's happening now is that for the last 10 years now, everybody's been exposed to entrepreneurship, right? You see everybody seeing, okay, those projects that work, those projects that don't work. And so you see the level of confidence in places that historically have always been very conservative, even in the GCC or in Europe and even in Canada, in other countries, now taking their stab at entrepreneurship. Right. Mm-hmm. They're seeing sort of example and reference points of projects that have been started locally get tremendous success. Right. And that changes the entire dynamic. Right. Where it's like, hey, we can build it here as well. Right.
Yeah.
And having sort of the outcome dictated by now renewed expectations. Oh, we can actually make it work. So from an investment standpoint, this is probably the most stimulating environment, really, era you can imagine, because you have, again, brilliant founders all around the world believing they can succeed for the first time. And that's what basically will pretty much guarantee they will succeed. So that's, you know, but you also have to look further than just, you know, your immediate block. And that's another thing as well too, that has been a restriction for a lot of investors in terms of how much they could invest in, you know, deal sourcing and vetting as well too. So you need to have right lenses as well too, because a lot of the opportunities that come from, let's say, those emerging nations or outside the United, they look different. They look different. So you need to have different lenses to be able to really truly quantify the upside that they do. And not only they look different, it's some of the needs that they have go beyond capital. So you need to also have a circle of competence where you can address a lot of the scalability impediments that they might have. So it's, you know, if you're armed with the right tools, this is an extremely exciting period.
Do you think in this period that the best de-risking strategy for an investor is to be operating across multiple markets or even regions?
Yeah, if you can. Yeah, absolutely, 100%. And it's not just in terms of, yeah, the de-risking, yeah, definitely in terms of the cross-pollination, the learning and so forth, but to be exposed to, again, the most successful labs are just conduct more experiments, right?
Yeah.
So it's the same thing in terms of investment, being able to see more and more variety and more perspective, that's basically going to have a direct bottom line in your ability to spot value. Right. And to be able to identify that, you know, if you stay, you know, outside of Harvard, you're going to see a very specific profile, very specific archetype of founders and ideas and conceptions and so forth. But if you're able to diversify from where, you know, where you source deals and to be exposed to that, that's, you know, it's an incredible asset. And again, you know, I was talking about, you know, a lot of people, you know, from the outside, when they were looking at our trajectory, it was hard to piece together everything we were doing. It's like, man, they're just done construction now, a couple of buildings. And, you know, they've done this telecom project and they sold these software companies. But this was perspectives that we were aggregating to allow us to do and see things differently. Right. So being able to expose to all those different segments, that basically gives you a complete advantage in terms of seeing things differently and being able to act on value in a way that's very, very different.
Do you think I'm very curious now. Do you think, do you foresee, that we're going to see the emergence of a new structure of investors or funds, like, you know, beyond the what we already know, angel investors, VCs, CVCs, family offices and stuff. Do you think with everything that is happening, there is the space for an emergence of a completely new structure?
There has to be. You know, if, and again, if you spend enough time in VC and you travel and you really understand just how inefficient VC is. Hmm. It's not a meritocracy. It's not true that the best founders get money, right? It's not true that the right ideas, the best ideas get capitalized. It's a massively inefficient. And there are obviously some constraints to investment that can, you know, play a role in that. A lot of cognitive biases as well, too, in terms of, you know, how decisions are made. It's not scientific, right? That's the truth of the matter is as well, too.
Yeah.
So they absolutely, there's tremendous waste of capital. That's the truth of the matter. So it must change, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you're seeing a lot of models now. And what's interesting is, so you see a lot of different models as well, too. You see a lot of the emergence of the venture studios as well, too, that are very interesting, that are able to provide, again, in addition to capital, a lot of different assets and bring a lot of values as well, too. And, you know, that makes sense. So, but you need to be able to afford, you know, to be able to provide that kind of support, right?
Mm-hmm.
Another reality is most investors are not founders, right? They haven't built projects.
Yeah, that too.
Right. So to ask these founders to diagnose issues in terms of business or economic configuration and how to address that, it's a tall order as well too. So a lot of them might not have the skill set required to transition to another format of investment, but there's absolutely no doubt that it has to be done differently. And again, the great thing is that it's not a burden, it's an opportunity. That means that based on how inefficient the investment in VC space is, there's a lot of money that's left on the table, a lot of money that's left on the table. So just that, right, that imperative is going to draw a lot of people that traditionally might not have been looking into investment. And from those, you know, different, you know, perspective will probably emerge a completely different way of doing VCs. But right now, like I said, anybody that spent time in VCs and looking at founders, no, it's not a meritocracy. The best deals actually go uncapitalized in a lot of aspects as well too. So that's why it's a must, but that's a great opportunity for everybody.
And a lot of underrepresented segments in that space, like women getting less than 2% of the that's distributed as well. So
that's exactly it. Everybody's bidding for the Bel Air, the Bel Air mansion, but that's not how you make money in real estate investment, right? It's, you know, that's not smart investment. So if you talk about, you know, value investing and grow investing, that's not the smart way of investing. But, you know, that's, you know, the existing paradigm, but 100%. And what's going to happen as well, too, is that as soon as some people very successful people, and we might know a couple as well too, that will have a lot of success with those new models. You know, all the LPs, you know, they belong to whoever can make them the most money as well too. So that's going to be a big shift coming in that space as well too. So it's inevitable.
It's amazing. Yeah. Henry, thank you so much.
Yeah.
This has been so enjoyable. I mean, I can go, you know, we can go on for a while longer.
Yeah. And anyways, we'll see you in a couple of weeks. We're back in Qatar, you know, and
I can't wait.
And it'll be very interesting as well too, you know, when we get to continue the conversation, because obviously Qatar is a huge part of what we're doing. Very excited. And obviously Allison as well too, a huge component, like the whole thing about the human capital and really sort of opening the eyes of the human capital part as well too. And a lot of the great work we're doing with the Gefta Institute, you know, comes from Allison as well too. So it's very, very big part of what we're doing going forward. There's going to be a lot of exciting announcement coming, but we're so excited. And again, just Qatar is such a unique place. I would, anybody listening, visit it. You know, it's a must visit. It's a unique, you know, the word we always use, the qualifier is it's wholesome.
It's wholesome.
We absolutely love the value. It's such a healthy place. And for us, yeah, obviously it's home, but you know, just to be able to do our best to make sure that it's preserved, you know, however we can contribute with, you know, the IP that we have, the, you know, and so forth. It's a jewel. It's an absolute jewel as well too. So we'll have a lot of great conversation and hopefully you get Allison on the podcast as well too.
Yes, definitely. I can't wait for that. But before I leave you, I have one last question for you, because that's a question I ask all my guests.
Yeah.
So the podcast is called Empowered to Grow.
Yeah.
How does this phrase resonate with you personally?
Empower to grow.
Yeah.
Right. So I would say, you know, so what's interesting about this entrepreneurship thing, right? One thing we always tell people is that what you end up learning after is that you're never building a venture, you're building yourself. Right. The business is almost a pretext if you do it the right way, right? If you're authentic and so forth, and you build it the right way, you'll find out that the opportunities that you attract, the people that you attract as well too, you know, you become a convergence point for a lot of those things, right? A lot of the things that you build as well too. And the type of people you attract, if you do it properly, good fathers, good mothers, good husbands, good wives, you know, remarkable humans, it's the type of people you can't lose with, right? Is the people that, and that's the ultimate currency. So the whole thing about really sort of building and cultivating and investing in yourself and so forth in that pursuit is when you look back at sort of the impact it's going to have on you, there's tremendous gains there. So we always say people, you know, go out, do things as well to invest in yourself, right? Invest yourself in others and what you're doing. And then basically what you get at the end is your fully actualized version of yourself, right? And that's you know, the ultimate sort of currency of, obviously money is going to come, you know, that's necessary. But that pursuit as well too is, you know, there's no better journey than that.
I love that. Thank you so much, Henry, for being with me tonight.
Yeah,
and absolutely. I look forward to continuing the conversation with you and Allison off screen, on screen, everywhere, because I know that we have this amazing connection.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for the invite. It was a pleasure, as always.
My pleasure.
Yeah, we'll
talk soon. Thank you to everyone who was listening with us today as Henry started the conversation. It's all about being authentic to who you are and making sure that authenticity is translated in your venture, in your business, in everyone you are destined to serve. And from that comes alignment. And from the alignment comes the economic building and the economic contribution to the societies you are in. And of course, at the end, how you wrapped it up, how you grow as a person alongside. And I hope that this is the message you take with you today. Whether you are an investor or a founder, it is about the growth, it's about the connections, and it's about the impact that you are meant to serve. As always, thank you for joining us, and I wish you love, abundance, and prosperity. We're going to see you next time. Bye for now.
Thank you. Bye. Thank you. Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Empowered to Grow podcast. I'll catch you on the next episode. And until then, know that empowered you empowers others. Love, abundance, and prosperity to you all.